Welcome or welcome back to the New Levels Coaching Podcast. Remember, we are the endurance podcast that brings you lots of inspiration and education. As always, I'm your host, Lewis Moses, and this week I'm joined by a very, very special guest. You may have noticed from our social media channels that we have partnered with Paula Radcliffe. Paula is coming on board as a coach consultant. And as I mentioned a lot on this podcast, we love providing the endurance community with inspiration education. And we don't feel like there's anybody better to be sharing their knowledge with the running world. So us having Paula on board will help us serve our running community a lot better. And we want to do that in the form of a podcast to start off. This podcast will specifically look at breaking the marathon world record and where that journey started for Paula. And what I hope to do is bring that back to you as a community so that we can share the same insights into what goes through an elite marathon runner's mind when they're looking to build up for a marathon, and also what you can take from that if you're looking to run your first ever marathon or whether you're on that marathon journey yourself. So firstly, Paula, welcome to the podcast.
Thank
and
you.
Welcome to the team.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here, and I really hope that I can bring just something to the table in terms of enhancing people's enjoyment of the marathon training, the marathon journey, which is a very special journey. And it's for me, a very, very special community, the community of marathon runners.
Well, that's where we'll start. So before we go into kind of the marathon itself and the world record attempts and obviously the world records themselves, I'd like you to give our community, our listeners, a bit of an insight into the why behind this relationship of coming on board with New Levels Coaching as a coach consultant, because I know you said to me you feel strongly about sharing your knowledge and expertise with the running world. Why do you want to stay involved in this space, particularly that coach education area?
I think the biggest reason is just that it's, as I said, it's a really special community. And in many ways, there's something magical about the marathon. It's captivating. It's kind of like that ultimate challenge of you working towards your goals against your mind, your body, but with that whole spirit and camaraderie that comes with it, which I think is very unique to the marathon. I don't think you find it easily in other sports. And there is something that you see dawn on a runner's face when they cross that marathon finish line. And it's not just about the journey in the race, it's the journey to that point and all the things that you find out about yourself along that journey. And I think you become a stronger, perhaps a more compassionate, more empathetic person. And I find that a nice community to be a part of. I also think that it's very similar to life as well. There are ups and downs in life, just as there are ups and downs within the marathon race itself. So all of those skills that I guess I kind of picked up through my journey, I'm really passionate about sharing that experience and that fun, that enjoyment with as many people as possible. I'm not particularly qualified as a coach. And I guess that's why it really appeals to me to come on more in this capacity, kind of like as a coaching mentor, because obviously when you've been coached or self-coached for many years, you kind of picked a lot of things up, but it's having the skills to be able to relate that to runners. And I think that's where your coaches come in. And by having a team, in my mind, a team is always a stronger functioning thing, entity, than it is if you're trying to do it on your own. So I think being able to kind of draw on that those different areas of expertise will hopefully put the subscribers and the people who are part of New Levels Coaching at an advantage in terms of getting absolute maximal reach for their training and for all of the hard work that everybody is putting into making sure they get 100% out of that race.
Well, I'm going to give one of my friends at university a shout out here, because he used to say exactly as you said, it's better as being a team. We used to we had a house of six guys at university, which a lot of people will think, oh, that's a worst nightmare, but we worked together as a team. We did the washing up, cooking together. And he used to say, together everyone achieves more, the team acronym.
Yeah.
And it's so true.
Oh, it's absolutely true. And I think maybe more true in athletics, even though we think about relays and things like that, than in the marathon, because in the marathon you've got to have such a team around you at whichever level you're running it. And people think of it as an individual race, but you've got to have the coach, you've got to have the family really supporting you, because you are investing a lot of time and effort, and you're also asking them to make sacrifices in a way to help you get the most out of yourself on race day. And then it's the training partners, it's those people that help inspire you, get out of bed on those mornings when it's still dark and raining outside and you don't want to get out for your run.
Well, I'm glad you've started there, because it would be easy for us to sit here and say, Paula, world record holder, world champion, you know, even going back to your cross country days, how many cross country medals you have as well. But the first thing you focused on is the community, the team, the camaraderie. And I can see even to this day how passionate you are about that community. And you used the word marathon journey, which I like, because I think people go on a marathon journey when they sign up to a marathon.
Yeah.
And they go on a marathon journey during the marathon. And from my perspective as a coach, I've only ran one marathon, which again, I had the kind of privilege of sharing the road with some very close people, including my wife on that day. And it brings people close together. But you feel like you are on a journey, even if you target one, if you target 10, if you go after the six marathon majors, it's always a journey. And I think that's what separates it from the other events.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think it's that magic of on a marathon day, and you will struggle to find any other sport anywhere in the world where you can have 55,000 people standing on a start line, covering the same course, the same distance, largely going through the same emotions, the same ups and downs. And every single person gets to that finish line a little bit stronger, a little bit wiser, and as part of a big team that's all done it on that day. And that's why one of the most inspirational places for me to be is the finish line of a marathon. And you see the exhaustion and the exhilaration on people's faces, and you see it dawning on them that they've done it, and it's something they've been working towards sometimes for more than a year, sometimes for 6 months, 3 months, but it's a build-up that they've done to get to that point. And then it's realizing that I've done it, and they're all celebrating together, and it's a really, really magical place to be. So if you're on the line and you're not sure whether to sign up for one, then absolutely go and watch the finish.
Well, this is a good comparison to other sports, isn't it, as well? Because you say 55,000 people on the start line of a marathon, or, you know, whatever that number might be. But you go across the sports, you say tennis, for example. It's very unlikely you're ever going to stand on a court with Serena Williams. You go to golf, it's very unlikely you're going to go onto the golf tee with Rory McIlroy or Nelly Korda and line up or play with the best in the world. But in our sport, in running on a marathon start line, you toe the line with the very, very best. You know, the London Marathon stands out. You have the elite start, and then you have the championship start, and then you have the good for age and the mass start, and everybody is classified in that same start. Yeah. And that's what I love about it.
Yeah, that's definitely the special part of it. And even now, a lot of years afterwards, I will meet people who will say, you know what, I was in the same race as you in 2002, in 2003, in 2005. And you can start chatting, yeah, but that's what the weather was like on that day. And that was what happened at this point. And that was when the course went that way and it didn't go that way. And it's that bringing together, and you kind of are in kind of that marathon club, and people just start talking about the different marathons that they've done and sharing experience and recommending different ones. And yeah, I think that's what pulls it together and makes it a cool community. And people help each other within the race. That, I think, is brilliant as well. So in my final competitive marathon in London, I ran on the mass start and absolutely loved it from start to finish, because I saw a completely different side of it. And I was in amongst the club runners and mass start and kind of queuing up at the start, making sure that you don't go off too quickly. And it was a really, really different side to it, because elite women go ahead of the others. So you don't really get the full depth of the crowd around you in the race.
And you enjoyed that as much, if not more, than being at the front of the elite women?
Yeah, I enjoy it all, to be honest. But I mean, obviously, when you're in the zone and it's going perfectly according to plan, you're running a world record, it's hard to top that.
Yeah.
But in terms of soaking in the atmosphere, when it doesn't really matter what time you run it in, then you actually take in a little bit more of that atmosphere. You can waste more energy if you like, but you can chat and help people around you, and you can share in that in the race camaraderie.
Because people say, don't they, I've never experienced London on the road. I've been there as a coach, I've commentated on London Marathon. But people say they go through the course and they sometimes don't even see certain landmarks because they're that in the zone.
Yeah.
But I imagine when you were in that mass start, you took in a lot more and you did look at Big Ben and you did see things on the course.
I was able to find really cool things. Like I had some friends from here that had flown out to watch me take part. And they called me the morning of the race and said, we're out in Bermondsey somewhere. Is there somewhere we could get to watch the race? And then I'm running along and they're actually in the middle of the road, and so I was able to pick them out, and it was really nice things like that that you wouldn't be able to do if you were actually head down trying to finish it as fast as you can.
And this is why I wanted to go to this episode in particular around the marathon and the marathon world record, because I think that the world record itself is unique because there's only one person holds it at any one time, which is fantastic. But there's a lot of similarities that we can pull from that experience. Like you say, whether it's looking for people on course or looking for that motivation, where am I going to get that motivation from? Whether it's hurting at certain points, which everybody goes through. And as you quite rightly pointed out, you're all doing the same course. You're all going to make the same turns. You're all going to experience those same hills and bridges and whatever else. So although this is a very unique conversation around going towards a world record and aiming towards it, I wanted to try and draw out all those kind of key characteristics that people can take away and go, you know what, the marathon is similar at any level.
Yeah.
So that's where we'll start, I think.
And I think it's absolutely true. I mean, in any marathon build-up, there are no shortcuts, so you've got to do the preparation you have pretty much for anything in life, but for the marathon, it's really, really key. And you have to do the consistency of preparation, so it's not about doing the odd amazing session. It's about putting back-to-back weeks of solid, consistent, almost average in sometimes, but it's just building on those blocks each time to work towards the goal. And it's really important for the marathon as well to train your mind as well as your body. And to think about all the little things like which drinks are going to get handed out along the course. Have I practiced with those? Am I able to tolerate those? Am I able to even drink moving along? Because that's a skill in itself. And so it is to practice all of those little things. And like I say, to find your, what do I call them? Like coping techniques, like your happy place that you're going to go to at those rough points in the marathon, because the are going to be rough points, and it's very rarely going to be one. There's going to be several of those, and there'll be times when you feel great as well. But you have to find in the training that technique that you're going to use to basically, simple as anything, just keep one foot in front of the other and just keep going and having faith that you're going to come through that and you're going to start feeling strong again.
And sometimes it's the crowd that pulls you through and keeps that one foot going in front of the other. Absolutely. Sometimes that is, it's that internal motivation. But I imagine people are tuning in, listening to this, thinking, oh, hang on. Paula's saying that she goes through not just one rough patch, but sometimes multiple rough patches in the marathon. And that'll almost be music to people's ears, because I think that's sometimes a misconception that the elites just find it easy, and they don't. They're just handling those rough patches well. They come up with strategies, but we'll go into it in a little bit more detail, but it does come down to practice, preparation, and almost having your go-tos. And I know what one of your go-tos was, which I will give a tip for later on. Let's backtrack, Paula, to when you decided to go to the marathon. Because again, a lot of people will be sat there thinking, am I going to go to the marathon? Am I not? You said it yourself. Am I going to go on to start line? Am I going to enter? You were very successful at the time you went to the marathon. World cross country champion, European champion on the track, I think in Munich. Mm-hmm. Was it Munich? Yeah. 10,000 meters. Almost breaking 30 minutes on the track for 10K, which is an unbelievable achievement. And then you made this transition, or you decided to go to the marathon and had your eyes on London. What prompted that initial decision to think, I'm going to go and do the marathon?
It was actually, with hindsight, a very, very long, slow build towards that marathon, in terms of the fact that I was, 11, and I was standing on the side of the road in London Marathon 1985 supporting my dad, and I saw Ingrid Christensen run past. And at that point in 85, it was mixed, so the elite women were buried in the elite men, and it felt to me like she was really near to the front of the race, and certainly a long way ahead of my dad. And I was just in awe of the whole day, the atmosphere, the other runners out there, the scale of the event, and just that her power and strength. And I just like definitely made, I mean, I was already racing, I was running cross countries, but I made it a goal in my head, like, one day I'm definitely going to go back and run the London Marathon. So that was always there. And then I started racing, obviously, shorter distances on the track, 3,000 metres, that changed to 5,000 metres, 10,000 metres. And I guess then the really serious point of building towards the marathon came in Sydney. After the Olympic Games in Sydney in 2000, I was gutted to finish fourth. I think I led for 23 and a half laps of that, and then just didn't have enough left in my legs to hold off. And unfortunately, there were three people on my shoulder at that 23 and a half
point. I remember watching that. It's like the whole nation was just praying for one more to drop off. I can imagine you were as well.
Thinking, come on, one more. But no. So I think then I just thought, okay, you know what? I'm not going to get the Olympic medal that I've always dreamed of on the track. So I'm going to start moving towards the road. And off the back of the Sydney Olympics, kind of had a little short holiday. And then I went and ran the World Half Marathon in Veracruz. And that was my first real half marathon. Actually, I ran the Great North Run, sorry, just before that. And that was only my second ever half marathon. And that went really well. And then I went and won the World Half Marathon. And I actually thought, you know what? I feel more comfortable. I feel more in control on the road. So I'm certainly getting better results. I just felt like I had more cards to play in the race and more tactics, more strengths, if you like, racing on the roads than I did on the track, where it was always about trying to shake people off and I could never quite shake enough of them off. Whereas in the marathon and the half marathon, I just felt like I could race more freely on the road. So that was when I think in my mind, I started to think, I should move towards the marathon. I watched the marathon in Sydney and thought, I could have done that. I could have raced in that race. And so then it became like a long-term move because it was extremely important to me to win the World Cross Country. And I still believe now that my grounding as a cross-country runner made me a better marathon runner.
Interesting.
Because what cross-country teaches you is to tune into your body. And it's not about the time, really. Nothing about time is relevant on the cross-country. It's about you racing the course and you getting every last ounce of energy from your body and just in time for the finish line, not running out of that a couple of hundred meters short of the finish line, and being able to run the strengths, your strengths, hard on that course. So learning different parts of that course. And it's very, very similar in the marathon.
And in a generation where we've almost become obsessed with the watch and the splits, I think that'd be really interesting for people to take that away about never losing that ability to run to feel.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, you know, a race is about getting from start to finish as fast or as economically as you possibly can. And yes, a watch may help guide you to do that, but ultimately you know your body better and you've got to be able to judge that. And a marathon is the true test of that in my eyes.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And it sounds strange telling people that because so many people have a time goal for the marathon. It's not like on the cross country, nobody has a goal there. But so many people will have a huge goal. I want to break 3.5 hours. I want to break 3 hours. And it's like the more obsessed you become with trying to run every mile or kilometre split in the right time to break 3 hours, the harder it actually becomes. So if you can kind of switch that off and maybe, yeah, tune into it every 5 kilometres or every half an hour or so, just to make sure that you're on target for it, but not getting too caught up into it and just tune into your body. And we talked earlier about coping techniques, and I think that's where my coping technique kind of really helped me do that, because I just counted in my head. So I just basically counted up to 100 and then started again. But thinking back where that came from, I used to run a lot of 2K reps in training, which had started out when I was an under 15 girl as basically 4 or 5 times 6.5 minutes.
Yeah.
And my coach would just be blowing a whistle. So he'd be blowing a whistle 3 minutes, and then he'd blow a whistle at 5 minutes, and then he'd blow a whistle at 30 seconds to go. So we had some idea of the time. And it became, I guess, a little bit of a game in my head to try and count in my head. So I'd kind of figured out, yeah, that to get to 3 minutes, it's roughly going to be just before 200. And then at 5 minutes, it's going to be about 300. And so then when I translated to the marathon, I was running around about 5-minute miles. It actually became a way of knowing where I was within the mile, because I would just count in my head and I would know that coming up to third time to 100, it's roughly going to be the mile. I'll be waiting for the mile split to come up ahead of me.
Interesting. So not just coping mechanisms, but like little tactical things that can help you along the way as well.
Yeah. Well, at the same time, you're just thinking about what number comes next. And I'd even forgotten about how I actually did it in terms of trying to guess the time. But then I think it just fitted perfectly for breaking that down. So little techniques like that that make you kind of escape out of the race while still staying focused on the race are really vital. And so I think that's why that helped me, because I was essentially thinking just about the numbers, but it was even breaking down within a mile split where I was within that race. So I wasn't losing concentration and imagining I was laying on the beach somewhere and I was going to miss the next bottle or miss the next mile split.
There's a couple of things I want to unpick from this. The first thing is back to London, about you standing on the sidelines, because, you know, Gemma and I always talk about this, about how we stood on the sidelines of London and watched you. We were the mini marathon. It's like, so our running journey was the mini marathon, and that's great. And we were becoming like good juniors in the sport. But watching you on the sidelines and being inspired by what we were seeing was incredible. That's why it's, you know, it's quite inspirational to sit here now talking to you about that same experience. It sometimes feels a little bit surreal, because everybody was wrapped up in that moment. And I think that's where sometimes it starts for people, is on the sidelines, you know, watching family members or friends, and you might get that little tingling in the belly. And if you do, I would just advise people to go for it.
Yeah.
But it doesn't always have to be the marathon. So for me, I was inspired by what I saw from you, but I wasn't inspired by the marathon. I was just inspired to push myself.
Yeah.
And I could always do that in a different event. But then the other thing was, that I always use as an example of the time when you ran 2:15, is I pull up your splits from that marathon and I say to people, look, I don't know what Paula was trying to run 2:15 that day, but she certainly wasn't trying to run dead even splits to run 2:15.
No.
Your splits were all over the shop, because you were in a rhythm, because the course is interchangeable.
Yeah. So I was going to say, I was running the course, and I think, first of all, I go back to my first marathon. So my debut over the distance in London in 2002. And I'd driven over it with my coach and Gary in months before, but then in the week before as well, just kind of looking at the course. And we really did not have a goal going into it. We kind of had no idea, because you've obviously prepared in training and you know you're in shape to run a marathon, but didn't really have any idea of any time that I wanted to run. And I remember just chatting with Gary and with my coach Alex in the couple of days before. I'm like, how am I going to run it? I said, maybe just don't do it. Just follow, run with a pack. It's a really strong field. Run with a field to halfway and then just have fun with it after that. But no specific times in mind whatsoever. So I set off. I've got no times in my mind. I'm just running with the lead pack, enjoying it, making sure I'm worried about getting your first drinks bottle and being able to get that. And that's kind of out of the way. And then we went into the area around the Cutty Sark, and the crowds were absolutely amazing. And without trying to, that kind of buoyed me a little bit, gave me a little bit of a surge of energy. And I remember coming out the other side of the Cutty Sark and thinking, I hadn't intended to break away. And then in the back of my mind, I've got my dad, from when I was 9, 10, 11, always saying to me, if you get away, never look over your shoulder, just keep going. So I was like, oh, shit, I've done it now. Better just keep going. And so I can't even remember exactly what went through halfway, but it wasn't quick. I think it was 72 something. And so I'd gone through halfway and I thought, right, okay, I actually feel all right now. And then a couple of my splits after halfway were really fast. So I remember thinking, okay, this is a bit too quick. This is like I think I was running 5:10s or something like that. And I remember thinking about Crammy and Brendan in the commentary, and they'd be going, oh, this is stupid. What is she doing this for? And I was like, I better not screw this up now. So I started just trying to like control it. And I really had no idea. I was just really running to feel then, because none of the split times particularly meant anything to me. Like if I saw a 17 mile split, meant zero. If I saw the 25K split, really didn't mean anything. And then I turned into the mall and I saw the clock over the finish line and it said 2:18. And I was like, I'm sure the world record's 2:18. And the world record was 2:18:47 and I ran 2:18:56. And I had no idea that I was that close to it. So I crossed the finish line And the first thing I said to Gary was, I can get that record. I know I can get that record. And then we started talking with different marathons and started talking with Kerry Pinkowski in Chicago about going there to break the record. And so then the rest of 2002 became kind of a real goal to trying to get that record. And then when I got that in Chicago, there were a number of things that day. I'd got my period the day of the race. It was freezing cold, which didn't really affect me that badly, but I just felt that there were a couple of things that had they been more in my favour, then I could go quicker. And so that's when it became a real goal to bring it back to London the next year. So the only time goal I had in my mind in 2003 was to beat the 2:17:18 from Chicago, because I wanted to set a world record. I really had no other times in my head, because it was one of the key things that we'd gone to in training all the time, is if you set a finite limit, what do you do if you're ahead of that?
Yeah.
So if you're ahead of the splits before halfway in a marathon, you're going to start panicking and thinking, well, that's quicker than I wanted to run. Do I need to slow down? So we rather set goals to run quicker than. So it was to run quicker than this. And one of the big goals was to try and break 2:16. And Gary had said to me a couple of times in training before that, and I think you're in shape. I think you can break 2:16. So then fast forward to coming towards the end of the race, and I'm coming along the embankment. And at that point, a lot of things were hurting, and it was really trying to just pour everything into the last 2-3 miles. And Peter Elliott was on the camera bike for the BBC that day, and he dropped back past the lead truck, and he dropped back alongside, and he shouted out, Gary says, if you pick it up, then you can run under 2:16. I was thinking, I'm picking anything up. This is as fast as I can go.
At Gary doesn't know how hard I'm trying.
It's going to be what it's going to be. But at the same time, it was really encouraging to know, because, again, my goals had been average mile split from Chicago was 5:13. So try and just hit as many miles as possible quicker than 5:13. And then in my mind, that was the simplest way to beat the record, was just to run as many as possible under that and not too many over. So I knew I was under it, but I didn't know by how much. So that, again, yeah, did give me that last little bit of impetus to just really try and pick it up as much as possible.
I find this all quite fascinating, particularly the London story when you mentioned Cutty Sark and going through there, because, you know, we're constantly telling the runners that we work with, be careful of Cutty Sark, and you're saying the same, you know, it's easy to get dragged in, and, you know, you hear the noise through there, and it's still early, it's like 10K into the race, so it's really early. And then you've got Tower Bridge at halfway, which almost has the same effect. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you'd heard the stories and maybe even had the same worries as of every other single marathon runner, that people say halfway in the marathon is not halfway.
Yeah.
And as you said, you had that little voice in your head saying, what's Crammy and Brendan saying? Mm-hmm. So the worries that you have are very similar to the worries that everybody else has.
Absolutely. And I think it's like the biggest thing and one of the best things that my coach Alex always used to say is you have to respect the marathon, but not be afraid of it. And I think that's the biggest thing, is if you respect it, and there are certain rules for a marathon. If you start off too fast, you will pay for it at some point. If you run the first half too quickly, you will end up paying for that. And it's much easier to run it in negative splits. And no matter how much the improvements in shoes recently have changed the landscape a little bit of marathon training and marathon racing, those old rules still hold true. And if you haven't done the long runs, you can't cheat. You can't take shortcuts to the marathon. You can't skip the crucial building blocks of the training. You still have to be able to do that. Having said that, don't panic to anybody who has gone through Cutty Sark and picked it up a little bit, because a little bit of a burst that you bring back under control is going to be okay. It's not like that's going to ruin your whole race. It's more if you've sustained too hard over 10K, 15K, then you're going to pay for that later on.
Yeah, it's that, and it goes back to your splits analogy about, we tend to try, or I certainly as a coach, try to work in 5K blocks. So rather than getting people to look at every mile, because I think that gives them more of an understanding of the rhythm that they're in. If they look at the 5K split, and let's say somebody's going to run, I don't know, saying, okay, well, we're going to go out and run 25 minutes per 5K. That's a nice round number, 5 minute Ks. It's just 8 minute mile in, 3:30 for the marathon. That's a really nice number, but you don't have to focus too much on that, but just have a look if you're ballpark around that section. Because then if you do have a surge at, say, a mile through Cutty Sark, you might only be sort of 5 or 10 seconds outside of that 25 minutes, but you've only done that over 5K. You've actually found your rhythm again. But we find the problems come with most people is that when they lock into that rhythm for too long,
yeah.
like you say, that I often yeah. say when people get to 10K in the marathon and they're still too quick, you almost know at that point
yeah.
the damage is
and
done.
You can feel it. And that's the other thing, is learning from that.
Yeah.
And ideally doing that in a build-up race or in training and learning what that feels like when you've gone too fast. So go and do a long run and set off quicker than you would normally do and see what that feels like and recognize that and scale it back when you get to that point. That's a really vital way to do it as well.
So here's a message to a lot of our listeners, because again, it's a common trend in the running world, and we've seen it a lot from working with now hundreds and thousands of runners, particularly marathon runners, who they make that mistake in training and they hear that that's the way that you should do it. You know, they call it banking the time, going out faster and banking the time, and they don't learn from it. And all the graphs of major marathons show you that that isn't the way to do it. No. Slowing down is not the most effective way to run a marathon. So the counter argument to that in the past that we've had as coaches is, oh, well, that's just for elite athletes to negative split. But I don't believe it is. I think the elites are just showing you the best way to do it. And you can do it as well. If you've done the training, if you're prepared, and if you're patient on the day, mm-hmm. it 100% is the best way to do it.
Definitely. I mean, just thinking about it logically, what is happening when you're slowing down is that you're losing efficiency in your form, your cadence is dropping off, your turnover is dropping off, everything is starting to feel much, much harder. So if you could not have that, and you can still feel strong. And that, in essence, I think is some of what the shoes are bringing in terms of advantages, is that the falling apart of your body, the bruising, if you like, of the muscles, the onset of DOMS, which is going to come in the next few days, but is already happening towards the end of that race, it's holding off that for a little bit longer. So if you keep your first part of the race under control, then you're putting yourself into that sort of negative debt, if you like, later in the race and building up all of that soreness far closer to the finish line. And one of the things that I also say in the marathon, if you move the finish line back 1K or even half a K just at the finish line as people are coming in, every single person is going to finish that race
yeah.
and they're going to be absolutely fine. But if you told them at the beginning they were going to run that much longer, it would be easier for them to do. And so it's just making sure that you judge it perfectly and exactly to that.
And it's one of those things, isn't it, where people, or certainly we refer to it as, like, don't see it as like banking the time. See it as you're going overdrawn. You're drawing out too much energy. And even just, again, look at it simply as the faster you go, the quicker you burn energy, the harder it is to refuel. And you've probably not practiced at that pace either. So you're not going to refuel effectively. Plus you're doing more muscle damage. So you're going to come back and you're going to have to pay it back with interest at the end, which is what we see. Just to kind of round off that point, we also are, again, it might just be me, but I know the coaching team feels strongly about this particular point about going out too fast. What we often see with runners is we do discuss splits with them because they want to have an idea of what pace to go out at. Now, let's say, again, I'll take a round number here because runners love working in round numbers. They're going to go off in, a 10-minute mile. Or we suggest that, and they say, there's no way I'm going to go off in 10-minute miling. That's too slow. And my counter-argument is, okay, well, if you don't want to go off in 10-minute miling, then sure as hell we're not going to see anything outside of 10-minute miling at the end of the race. But the mistake people make is they go off at, say, 9-minute miling, and then they slow to, like, 11, 12, 13s because they walk.
Yeah.
But they're not prepared to do that at the start. But they're all always prepared to do it at the end to get them to the finish. But there's a really good way of not doing that. It's just by bringing that first part back a little bit, conserving that energy.
And that's where sometimes actually in a big mass race, so something like London, it can be a little bit of an advantage to actually be in that zone, because the sheer volume of people running around you will hold you back.
Yeah.
And everybody is kind of, we're in this together, let's try and not panic, let's try and not waste energy zigzagging and trying to overtake people at this point. Just be patient and just let that crowd almost hold you back, and then you can get into your running and it will open out later in the race and you'll be able to run more freely and to use that energy more. And another tip sometimes is, if you know you're not good at drinking and getting energy in on the run is actually take the time just to stop and walk through those early energy stations and just to make sure that you top up your glycogen stores then, because then you can save time in the second half of the race running right through them and going through them, because you don't need to top up because you banked that in the beginning.
Yeah, when they're less busy as well later on in the race, because they're always rammed at the start. So take your time, don't panic, don't rush and think, and certainly don't think, oh, I'm just going to miss this one because it's busy. Yeah, a really good tip there. So back to the point you made about the first time you went to the marathon, because I think a lot of people will believe that you went to the marathon and you were going to attack that world record on the first time you did it, and you're saying, actually, you know what, I was aware of it, but I didn't even have a time to aim towards.
No, I mean, bearing in mind I was starting with the London Marathon, so already a goal to try and win the London Marathon is a pretty hard goal to go in with for your first marathon. So I think that was really as big as I went, and I waited. I mean, I was 28 when I ran my first marathon, and it was really important to me that even though the physiologists had been saying since I was 18 you're going to be good at the marathon, the marathon is going to be your distance, it was really important to me to have achieved those goals over the shorter distances, because actually I did run quicker over the shorter distances after the marathon, but I had no way of knowing that, and the old adage was that you wouldn't. So I wanted to make sure I'd run as fast as I was capable of doing on the track, that I'd won that world cross country, and also that I really wanted to do it, because I think I fully understood that the marathon is tough and you can't go in half wanting to do it. You've got to really be all in terms of the training and the racing to get the most out of it on race day. So I think I wanted to wait until I was really like champing at the bit to get out there and race it, and really, really excited, because I knew that would be a good way to run it.
I think that's a good tip for a lot of people who go into marathons because their friends do it or somebody tells them they should do it. We find the best success comes from people who either love the marathon training, love the marathon distance, they're all in, they're all committed, or whether they've chosen to represent a charity or they're doing it in memory of a loved one. We find that they often get better results because they are all in. It has more meaning to it. Whereas people who do it half-heartedly and, you know, oh, I don't like the long runs and I don't really, you know, get on with running long. Well, my first question to them often is, well, why are you doing the marathon? You know, go and attack those shorter distances and have some fun with them and maybe come to the marathon later on. So it's, again, refreshing to hear you say, actually, you know what, I went to it quite late because I had a lot of unfinished business at the shorter distances first, even though everybody was probably telling you from a young age, you're going to be a marathon runner, including the physiologists. So when you went then and you didn't have that time goal, because one of the biggest questions we get asked, and when you're working with us, we'll pick your brains on this, people come in and say, well, what time do I run? You know, how do I know what pace to set off at? You know, you're helping me now, you're my coach. Will you tell me what time to run? And then we kind of hold back and say, we'll have that discussion on the week of the race, but let's just focus on the training first. And they say, but do I not need to know what time I'm going to run in order to do my training at that pace? Because I should be doing my training runs at that pace. What's your thoughts and theory on that?
Oh, that's a tough one, because it's almost like, it's like the chicken and egg situation, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because I'd say the biggest thing is that from my training, I knew I was ready to race when I'd got the long runs banked at the pace that I'd got them put in at. And I did used to go according to time on my feet. So actually, I ran for 2:15.
Interesting.
And that was my long run. But I built up to that through the training. So I would start out at the beginning of the block of training for the marathon at 1:45 for my long run. Then it would go up to 1:50. It would go up to 2 hours. Then it would go up to 2:05, 2:10, and then 2:15. And then I would stick there for I guess probably I'd try and get 5 or 6 of the longer ones in there, and I would do a mile warm up and warm down for those, even though the warm down would be very slow. Shuffle, just to kind of help the recovery process. So actually, volume wise it was getting close to marathon distance, but hard running was not the marathon distance. It was, I guess, around about 22, 23 miles at the longest, because I was doing that at altitude as well. But the key part of it for me was training my mind and my body to be doing that marathon effort. And so I think that's what you have to more concentrate on, is how do I get the most out of my body for that goal period of time? And can I get that as close as possible to the marathon distance? And then I'm going to be close to my times. If you obviously have no idea what time you want to run in the marathon, you can essentially just go and have fun with it and just start learning it. And that's where you can get it wrong a few times. Okay, I'm going to do a 20 miler. I'm just going to see how fast I can run it and use that as a training. And that is an excellent gauge of then being able to add on. So what you can run a 22 miler in training is probably pretty close to the same pace that you're going to run for the full distance when you're fully rested down, tapered, you've carbo loaded and all of those things.
You've got that atmosphere in the day. It's going to pick you up and you always get that extra percent. Yeah, I think with the people listening in here, they're going to take a few things from that, including, you know, the effort, the term effort. We use that a lot, but people tend to go off the term pace. You know, they see training plans and it says, let's do a 20 mile long run with 10 at marathon pace. And then they automatically assume, and rightly so, because they see that written down, that they have to hit their marathon pace within that run. And we have to have that conversation with them around, well, it's actually really hard to hit marathon pace in training on tired legs when you're not carbo loaded and you've maybe gone out early and you've maybe not had time for breakfast in this busy life that we live. So the word effort is a lot better. As long as it's at the right effort, it's going to be in and around the intensity we're looking for. And that's all we're looking for, is that intensity, that zone. But the other thing that we can take from it as well is what you were saying there, is when you get to sort of those distances of 20 miles, you can't do 26 miles at marathon pace before the marathon, because that's your marathon.
Yeah.
And so many people want that confidence boost beforehand. They want to go as long as they can and as close to marathon pace. And I do believe that's just because psychologically they want to know they can do it.
But I really think that, and that's the other thing that I went back to with my first one, because again, you go into it and I think I'd probably run 22 and a bit miles maximum in my longest run before. And then I think it was my coach or Gary said to me, you know what, you've basically essentially got 4 miles.
Yeah.
And 4 miles is shorter than your easiest run that you've done. So when you're really, really tired in those blocks of training, you can always go out and you can do a 4 mile run. So however tired you are, when you get to 22 miles, you're always going to be able to finish from there. Like most people who are going to hit the wall have started to hit it a lot before then.
Yeah.
And so when you get to there, you're going to be able to do that bit. If you get to there feeling strong, then you're going to be able to close the final 4 miles. So yeah, I think it is about saving that for race day. And you probably don't understand, in all honesty, until you've run your first one, how much better you feel, because you don't even feel great when you're tapering down. Some people start to feel like a little bit jumpy, a little bit heavy leg, because you're not going out and doing as much running. You start to feel a little bit more bloated because you're trying to shove as many carbohydrates in as possible. So when you actually get out in the race and everything feels good and you're running along, that is a little bit of an extra boost as well, on top of the adrenaline of the race and the support of the crowd and the atmosphere. So there are so many things that are conducive to being able to run faster and feel better on race day. And the training really is about, for me, it's about putting the base in and making sure that you're ready. And it's about putting the psychological blocks in place to get you through on race day, because physically all the training is going to get you through race day.
It's the, I refer to it as the unknown zone. So it's the one event, unless you're doing ultras, of course, where most runners don't cover race distance, and obviously at race pace, before the event itself. So there's almost like this black hole of, let's say somebody gets to 22 miles on a training run. There's the black hole from 22 to 26.2. There's 4.2 miles of unknown in there. But if you strip that back and say, let's go back to 5K, 10K, half marathon, most runners will have done 5K, done 10K, done half marathon. So there isn't as much of an unknown zone in there. And I do feel like you've hit the nail on the head. There's just these psychological blocks and people are in fear of that unknown. But I think if you embrace that unknown, that's why you're taking on the challenge. Again, that's when we see real success.
And I think that's a big part of it, is see it as a challenge, see it as something fun. And I honestly think that's why I love the marathon so much, because I actually love that challenge. I love that little bit of a battle of, how much harder can I push my body? How close can I get to that line which feels like I can't go over it? And just hold it there, hold it there, hold it there. And it became like a game almost, but that was having fun with. And I think that's the big thing, is like embracing that challenge. And at the end of the day, whether you finish it or not, it's not life and death either. So it is a little bit of fun as well. And it's about, there will always be another one that you can go to. And for anybody who is really scared for their first one, I think I was as well, because as much as people can tell you on paper, physiologically, you're going to be great at the marathon, until you've run one, you don't know. And you're right about that unknown gap. Nobody knows.
No.
So it's kind of like just jump into it and just see what happens. Because more often than not, if you're prepared well, you're going to be fine through that. And then your second one, you almost come to with a little bit less anxiety for that one and a little bit more fear of, oh, can I match what I did last time?
One of the key messages you keep saying is about if you're prepared well, you know, that if you're prepared well, you're obviously at such an advantage. But you also mentioned that doing a 20 miler and I'm going to use the word failure, and failing isn't a bad thing. But so many people who we work with, they worry if they have one bad run, for example, or one bad training session. And I think that there's a real emphasis here from you that don't see that as a failure, see that as a chance to learn from it and then potentially put that right. But don't judge yourself because of that, because it happens to everyone, doesn't it?
It absolutely happens to everyone, and it happens in so many things in life as well. We're all going to learn far more from the things that we fail rather than the places where things come really easy and success is really easy. You learn far more but from those tough times, and you become a much stronger person from them. And if you can put it so that it's a lot more in training rather than racing, it's a lot nicer way to kind of learn from those mistakes. But in essence, failure is just not getting to your goal the first time.
Yeah,
and then you've just got to find another way to work towards that. So calling it failure, you could not try at all and you'd never fail.
Yeah.
But you'd also never succeed at anything either. So it is about kind of just putting everything into it. And that's where, again, the whole team thing comes into play. Because in most people's team, yes, on the day, it comes down to the core person in that team getting it right and going out there on the day. But no person in that team is going to be cross if anything happens out there. Or you might feel like you're letting your team down, but you're not at all, because they just want to see you run well. And it will happen in time. If it doesn't happen the first time, it will happen after that. And there are plenty of other goes down the road where you can try again.
Yeah. You couldn't have said it any better. Yeah. You keep going until you achieve it, or that journey will take you somewhere else and you'll veer off and you'll go and hit another goal that you've been aiming towards, and it's all part of the same journey. So the world record day itself, obviously a lot went right for you. And you'd said, I think it's a really interesting point about Chicago, about how a lot of people have looked at that and gone, fantastic result. You probably came away from it and thought, there's more there. Because as a woman in the sport, you've got to deal with things like the period happening on the day or in the week, which I know a lot of people struggle with. We've been speaking a lot these last couple of days about the menstrual cycle and also the menopause, which a lot of female runners have to deal with.
Yeah.
And it can just affect performance on that particular day. So again, it's about almost learning from those experiences and moving forward with them, but then maybe recognizing actually there's more in there.
Yeah.
But on the day of the world record, did just everything seem to fall into place? Was it one of those days where it clicked?
Yes, but I think there were lots of factors that came into play, and over the build-up of the whole preparation into it, really. But I think definitely the last kind of 3, 4, 5 weeks. So I think it was about 5 weeks out, and I was on one of my last long training runs in Albuquerque, and I was running along the bike path alongside the Rio Grande. And so I'm getting to the end, to the last mile. I think it might have gone to like 23 and a bit miles. It was one of the furthest that I'd done. And there was a little girl on a bike in front of me, and I just passed her mom. And as I went past her, she turned back to see where her mum was behind. And so she turned the front wheel of the bike, and that caught my back foot. And I just face planted and skidded along the bike path, dislocated my jaw, smashed my heart rate monitor, and ended up with a little bit of whiplash. But the biggest thing was that I had hurt my jaw a little bit, and I'd scratched my shoulders, but I'd hurt my knee as well. And my hip kept clicking out, and it felt like it just needed to be mobilized all the time. So we'd been able to do some really good training and recover okay from the cuts and scrapes and stuff in the build up to it. But in my massage the day before, my physio was just doing a little bit of hip stretches and mobilizing, and there was just this massive clunk, and it just felt like it went back into place. So that, in essence, felt a little bit like a sign to me, okay, right now, everything is good. I knew the training was already, but in the back of my mind was, is my hip going to tighten up at like 15 miles and start to become an issue. So the fact that that freed up like that was really, really important. And then we'd been down to London, I think on the Monday before the race, to do the press conference, and then gone back up to Loughborough for a couple of days before coming back down for the race. And then Gary got sick. And then someone called us from the marathon and said, yeah, the guy who drove you to the press conference has now got really bad food poisoning or a virus or something. He'd got really sick. So Gary just moved away completely, never saw him. And I was absolutely fine all the way through. So I think that was, again, another sign, because as many people know, marathon training, sometimes your immune system just gets a little bit run down. The good point was that I was in the tapering period, so I was already kind of strong at that point and I was able to hold it up. And then I think race day, I just got up, opened the curtains, looked out. And when you see that sun's shining, it might be a little bit chilly, there's not too much of a wind, they're kind of the things that you want to fall into place. So yeah, in terms of having done the best preparation that I'd ever done into it, aside from falling over, yes, that was really, really there. Conditions on the day were great. For me, I think London was the best place. A lot of people have spoken to me about how there are faster courses, and there are, I mean, Valencia's fast, Berlin's fast. But for a British person who's grown up wanting to be there at the front of the London Marathon and then to be there in front of a British crowd, I don't think there's a faster place that you can run. And without a doubt, the crowd in London helped me massively. And it's not that the crowd in Chicago wasn't great, they were, but the London crowd is just always going to be better for me. So I'm sure that was another big factor in, yeah, that day just feeling really, really strong.
It comes back to the why, all the way back to watching your dad initially, mm-hmm. and seeing Ingrid on that course, and then you're then going through that, and then you've probably in some way subconsciously resonated with where your marathon journey started at 11 years old, and then it's the crowd, the atmosphere, the, like you say, everything just falling into place.
And also the fact that because I had fallen, because there had been that period when you think that something that you're really looking forward to and you're really working towards is going to be taken away, and you get the chance to do it, it's almost like you appreciate a little bit more. There's a little bit less pressure, because it's what I could have not even been standing on this start line. So I'm not going to be standing here scared and nervous about what's going to happen. I'm just going to go out and enjoy it.
And you know what? There's so many examples of that in the last few weeks of races and marathons. And I think there's a lot to take from it. Like, we look back at Tomo in Kew Gardens when, you know, he obviously had little Theo in the last couple of weeks of the race, but he'd also crushed his hand. His dad had backed the car into his hand while they were packing up the house. And people don't know that, but there's loads of examples of this in the last few weeks where people have this injury. But I think it comes down to how you deal with it, again, psychologically. Can you block it out? And you've almost turned it into a positive there by saying, oh, I was fortunate I could still stand on the start line. If you do that, then you're already winning. But again, people at home have got London coming up, and or it might have even been passed by the time we've published this episode. They'll had a major marathon either coming up or are going to do in the future, and you will have a setback even in the last week or the last couple of weeks. And I think the key message is here, don't panic. A lot of the training is done at that point.
It is. I think it's more, and it's that old saying, isn't it, that you'd rather be 100% healthy and 90% fit on the day than the other way around. You'd rather be 100% fit and rather not be 100% fit and just not quite healthy, because whether that's a little bit of a niggle that you're carrying or whether you're fighting something off, it's really hard to be that way around. It's far better to not quite have done enough training, but to be standing there really excited, ready to go and fully healthy.
Give yourself that chance. Yeah, definitely. So to kind of round this all off, Paula, and to kind of bring it all together, there's a lot of things we've touched on here. You've mentioned consistency, you've mentioned not getting too bogged down with the time, enjoyment, you know, almost feeding off that crowd, having a reason to be on the start line, really understanding why you are there as well. In terms of tips for people who are either on the fence with the marathon and thinking about doing one, or doing another one, you know, being tempted back in. What are your best tips for them to make sure that they enjoy that marathon experience, both the training experience and the marathon itself?
How many have I got?
I'm going to give you two or three.
Okay. I think the biggest one is it's obviously to set a plan. I'm going to expand this one out for a fair bit.
I'm glad you said
yeah,
this.
you need to set a plan and to ideally join together with a group. And it can be a couple of friends. It can be a training group. It can be an online group that you come together. It's that camaraderie and just that not going through it completely on your own. And in that extra motivation, okay, as we talked about, those dark winter mornings, I've got to get out and I've got to do my run. But it's okay because my mate's also doing it, or I've got to get there because I've got to meet them to be able to run with them. And I don't want to be joining that Zoom call at the end of the week and saying, I'm the one that didn't go out on Wednesday morning and get my run done. So those kind of motivations really help. And when I say write that plan down, I think it's really important that you kind of put it down in a structured training plan and then look back at it as you're coming into the race. So you can look back and say, okay, I might not have done one amazing session, this whole build up, but I've done those weeks of solid sessions and I've got that done. And even when I wasn't feeling great or the weather was really bad, I got that long run done and I did that. And sometimes go back and revisit the tougher parts of that training build up before the race and think, right, if I got through that, I guarantee the race is going to be easy.
I'm going to stop you on that point because I think there's two really, really good points in there, because what we find a lot with people we work with is that they do this fantastic training block and again, they have either a week that goes wrong or a couple of runs that go wrong or something goes wrong and their mind automatically focuses on those mm-hmm. bits.
Yeah.
And we keep saying to them, you know, go back and look at all the good work yeah. you've done.
It's the bigger picture and Absolutely. It's the blocks and blocks that you're building up. So it's all the steps you're putting in place rather than the height of one step yeah. in there, because in fact, that's just going to upset your rhythm. And I think the other thing that perhaps people don't do enough or think about too late is the whole fueling and diet side of it as well, particularly for the marathon. So you're putting so much effort into, have you got the right shoes? Have you done the right training? Have you done the right pace stuff? Have you done the right recovery? Have you been sleeping enough? Have you tried making sure that the exact breakfast you're going to have on race day you've had before your runs? Have you made sure that if you're going to City of London, if you're going to New York, if you're going to Valencia, are you going to be able to find what you want to eat the night before? Something that you've been used to, because you don't want to be experimenting with something yeah. you've never had the day before a long run. You want to be leaving as little to chance as possible by kind of covering those things off.
I think that links back to the team thing as well. So if you all go on that journey together and, you know, you share these experiences mm-hmm. and try things together or, you know, work together. But even some people's team might be as close as just their family come on board. Mm-hmm. I love it when I see, you know, let's say a mum is doing the marathon and their husband's fully bought into that process and they're there on the day supporting them. They've got a little family and the family are there holding the boards up on the side of the course. And I just think that is a team mm-hmm. And they're all bought into that journey, because it takes a lot for a family member to go through a marathon training program and a lot of sacrifice, not sacrifices from the runner, but certainly sacrifices from the family,
yeah,
to give them the time to do that.
I think it's giving them reward too as well. So it's been able to work that in, which also as a mum certainly helps, kind of that you're not having mum guilt because you're just doing what you want to do and going out and racing, making sure that there are benefits for the whole team in that. So even as much as in training and in preparation, get the kids out there joining in for a mum. And that's yeah. what I started doing with my dad. Absolutely loved it. And that's what got me into running. Get them handing you drinks or biking alongside you, because it's helping them to see a pattern of a healthy, active lifestyle as well, but also to get firsthand view of working towards a goal and yeah. achieving it. So when they stand there and see their parent cross the finish line, they know how much work has gone into that. It's not been achieved overnight. There is a whole lot of hard work gone into that. And that's a life lesson.
Yeah. The athletes in our community that sometimes say, oh, nobody can take inspiration from me, can they? I'm like, they absolutely can. Mm-hmm. You know, there's people on that street who might see you and think, God, I can relate to that person more than I can relate to, you know, Kipchoge at the yeah. front of the marathon.
Kipchoge doesn't have to manage a family and washing up and making sure that they've been to the shop and
exactly.
got enough in for everybody to eat and kids have got everything for school that they need. Somebody does that all for him. Elite athletes, we don't have to do that side of it. So I think that's why there's so much goes in to the whole team around someone getting to their first marathon and enjoying the experience and everybody being there celebrating together at the end.
And if it's not a family, it can be running clubs, it can be communities. You know, we have our own community at New Levels Coaching, and we do often go to the major marathons and celebrate together. We're in Valencia before Christmas, which was just fantastic. And it's not just, I think I want to make a really important point here, it's not just celebrating the success of those people in your community, in your team. The beauty of the marathon is standing on the sideline and celebrating everyone's. You know, you hear walls of noise when different people come past, and that's what makes it brilliant. You don't even know who they are, and you're screaming at them, shouting at them, because everyone's going through that same experience. And that's what's brilliant about it. So I'm glad, in a way, we've, you know, you started with that aspect of the team, and it's come all the way back to that. So it might be an individual sport, but if you are thinking about the marathon and you've never taken one on, then maybe think about, what does that team look like for you, and who do you surround yourself with? Because I think that's also important, surrounding yourself with the right
people. The challenge as well, I think, look out there, there are so many cool marathons out there. So pick one that really inspires you, because as we've talked about, along that road and that training road, there will be tough times, and there will be times when you question, what on earth am I doing? Why did I pick this challenge? And so when the why, as you said, is that much bigger and that much more inspiring, it's far easier to kind of push through that bit. So yeah, just flick through them. It might be the Antarctica one that really makes you think, okay, you know, I would really like to do that. Yeah. It really is about picking one that lights a passion with inside you.
I think it was the Irish marathon runner, wasn't it, who had, might have broken the record for that one in Antarctica recently. Yeah, I looked at it, I was like, jeepers, that's a marathon and a half, that one. Yeah, oh, it's brilliant. I could talk all day here, Paul, about the marathon, and I'm sure this is only one of maybe a couple of episodes that we come back to and we pick your brains on. But in the future, you know, I want to express to our community that we are going to be able to pick your brains a lot more, which is brilliant.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to kind of being a part of that and sharing that.
Amazing. And I think this will just highlight, just, you know, I think the reason I wanted to bring you in as soon as I found out we could was that I always remember something that you said to me that just baffled me, is you said a lot of people don't ask you enough about the marathon. And I found that absolutely fascinating. So we have this now, this unique chance to ask you things that you learned that can be applied to anybody of all abilities. And hopefully that can just help one person to run a better marathon. And if we get that achievement, then we've succeeded. So opportunities are going to come to join either Paula at some workshops that we do. There'll be content that we put out on YouTube and on social media that anybody can have access to, and there'll be lots of tips and advice on our social channels coming your way. We're also going to launch the first ever Paula Radcliffe Marathon Academy, so stay tuned for that. And if you would like to be part of that, we're going to put out a waiting list for that, so I'm sure you can join that waiting list if you want to find out how you can use Paula's knowledge and brain and our coaching expertise to help you run a better marathon. I hope you enjoyed the episode. If you've had a marathon recently, or if you've got one coming up, we hope it's helped you on that journey. And if you're sat on the fence, hopefully we've just tipped you over the line to get you on a marathon start line. Thanks again, Paula.
Thank you.
I've loved it. And thank you for everybody tuning in.